Chapter 10. Joshua spent his first night alone on Earth West 1,520,875 up a tree. Not that he tried too hard to keep count. This was a sabbatical after all, and counting kind of wasn't the point. And since the deletion of a whole world, of Earth West 1,217,756, doomed by an infestation of alien creatures, and with the long Earth sealed up to either side of that wound, such numbers were probably meaningless anyhow. Just now, in fact, the choice of tree had been more significant than the choice of world. He had found this tree, standing on this rocky bluff, had selected a stout branch, and lodged himself in the angle of branch and trunk. He made sure his pack was hanging where he could reach it, pulled his outer coat up over his legs, and then tied himself in place with a few loops of rope. This had been his habit when striking out alone since he was a boy, when he had first sought safety high in trees. He laughed at himself. "I learned all I know about surviving in the wilderness from Robinson Crusoe," he told the empty world. Because climbing a tree was exactly what Crusoe had done on the first night on his island. As it happened, Joshua had a copy of the book itself in his pack, one of just two books he'd brought with him. The Crusoe was an ancient paperback, the very copy he had read himself as a boy in the home. It was heavily annotated in his own rounded child's handwriting, an act of graffiti that had earned him punishment detail from Sister Georgina, potato peeling as he recalled. Well, he fully intended to return this copy to the bookshelf that Sister John, only half-joking, called the Joshua Valiente Library. "I won't be out here forever," he told himself. He was dog-tired. He tried napping without success. Then again, the sun had yet to set. Chewing on jerky, sipping water, he inspected his new home. This was a distant relative of Montana, more than 1.5 million steps from the datum. He was somewhere near the loosely defined border between the band of rich green worlds in which the footprints of North America were dominated by a vast, shallow inland ocean, the so-called Valhallan Belt, and the much more arid, less travelled worlds further out, worlds so unwelcoming they had only a scientist label, the Paravenusian Belt. For sure, this looked like a transitional world, with the eroded aridity of a Paravenus broken up by watercourses and clumps of trees of species unknown to him, but looking vaguely deciduous, seasonal, water-loving. He was alone, just like Crusoe. Nobody knew he was here. In fact, he'd gone to some trouble to ensure that. After he'd told Agnes and the sisters and Bill Chambers and Rod and a few other selected contacts that he was off on a sabbatical, he'd taken one of the few big commercial twains that still sailed the long Mississippi run from the Low Earths to the city of Valhalla, 1.4 million steps west. In the few days on board, he had fattened himself up with the richest food he could find and soaked his aging body repeatedly in clean, soapy water, and he'd got his teeth fixed by the onboard dentist. He'd even had his prosthetic left hand serviced by a Black Corporation technician attached to the crew. Once at Valhalla, he'd hitched a ride at random on a smaller twain, a mineral prospector's private vehicle, and sailed off for another 100,000 worlds or so, letting himself be carried crosswise geographically to the footprints of Montana. And then he'd stepped further on foot, travelling deeper through this band of transitional worlds, heading steadily into the wilderness. So here he was in this world, on this bluff, high in this tree. Plenty of people must have travelled through this world before him, heading on out west. He'd gone further out himself many times. Maybe a few people had even settled here, although only the hardiest pioneers would be this far out. So what? Even most of the low Earths, the alternates right next to the datum, had never really been explored, not beyond the most easily habitable places. Why would you bother to go somewhere difficult? More than 5 decades after step day, go just a little way off the beaten track, and you found yourself in exotic, untouched wilderness. which was the way Joshua liked it. He'd chosen his geographical location with care, too. He wasn't far from a river. This particular tree he sat in, something like a small-leaved sycamore, was one of a clump that had sprouted on top of a sandstone bluff. Further down the bluff, on the southwest face, and still a few yards above the sandy ground, he'd found a hollow, not quite a cave, but with some effort, he could probably dig his way into the soft rock and deepen it. That would give decent shelter, and he'd get plenty of light and a good view of the landscape. As for security, a look with an experienced eye had informed him it wouldn't be too much labour to construct a stockade to block off the ground approach to the hollow. The smoke from his fires ought to keep any critters off the bluff itself, and he could lay a few traps for any sneak attacks from humans or humanoids coming from above. And the forest clump above the bluff would serve as a reserve of firewood, if he did manage to get himself besieged in here. He could get it all constructed and stocked up for the winter. He'd arrived at midsummer, and anyhow, Joshua hoped the cold wouldn't be too severe on this world. He would have to learn the local landscape, the essentials like forest clumps and water sources, and landmarks for when he got turned around in a storm, or was fleeing a grizzly bear or some such, and had to make snap decisions about which way to run. In time, he would extend that mental map into a third dimension to include similar landmarks in the nearby stepwise worlds. Once he'd invested all the labour in his stockade, he was going to be tied to this world, at least until he chose to end the sabbatical altogether. But the stepwise worlds were always there as refuges, only sapiens could step, and as alternate sources of food, of escape from bad weather, even hides to use when hunting. He'd never had any trouble with this kind of mental mapping. Lobsang had come to the conclusion that this sort of visualization of the world, or worlds, was at the core of his enhanced ability to step in the first place, and it paid to be prepared, because there were always threats out there. At least you knew that what animals wanted of you was primal, either to eat you or to avoid being eaten by you. Sapient threats were worse, both from malevolent humans and from some variants of humanoids. Some thought of the Long Earth humanoids as mere animals. Nobody would ever convince Joshua that there was no malice in the heart of some of the killer elves he'd encountered over the years. "Well, Crusoe had his cannibals," he told the world now, "and I got bandits and elves. But he intended to live to tell the tale, and so do I." No reply. This was a quiet world, he thought. No bird song. And he hadn't even heard the trolls' long call, not an echo of it, which was kind of unusual. Trolls were to be found most everywhere. But one reason he'd stopped here was precisely because of that absence. He liked trolls, but right now he didn't much want to be around any of them, because if a troll saw you, he or she told the pack, who added the news to their long call, the endless, improvised opera that united all trolls everywhere in a kind of bath of information. If your name was Joshua Valiente, the news tended to get out, and next thing you knew, the whole long earth knew what colour your boxers were. Now there was a sound in this quiet world, a deep rumble from far away to the north, like a lion's roar, maybe, but deeper. Almost like something geological. A big beast advertising its presence. Just as he needed to know his landscape, Joshua was going to have to learn about the creatures he shared his world with, although with any luck, he'd never need to get close up and personal with most of them. It was a classic High Megas landscape, and as the sun dipped towards the horizon, Joshua Valiente was king of all he surveyed.
"In Madison, when I was a kid, I was nothing," he announced. "Didn't want to be nothing. Soon, as I went stepwise with everybody else stumbling and crying and I just strode away, I was something. Me, Joshua Valiente, right here."
Fine. So why the hell couldn't he sleep? He took his second book out of his backpack. It was a fat paperback, sheets of coarse low-earth paper crudely bound together. And it wasn't aging well. This was Helen's journal,
which she had started to keep at age 11, before she went trekking with her family into the long earth. It was pretty much all of his marriage that he'd kept, this book and his wedding ring. He flicked at random through the pages.
"I miss being online. I miss my phone. I miss school. Or some of the people in it anyway. Not some others. I miss Rod. Even though he could be a weirdo. I miss being a cheerleader. Dad says I should say some of what I like too. Otherwise this journal won't be a fun read for his grandchildren." Grandchildren? He should be so lucky.
If he cried himself to sleep, it was nobody the hell's business. In the dark of night, under a subtly different moon, he was disturbed. There were the usual cries in the dark, as a population of feeders and hunters came out of the shadows and the burrows and the tree stumps to live out their nocturnal lives. A subtle symphony of hunger and pain, as one little life after another was sacrificed to serve as a few hours' worth of food for something with sharper teeth. No, that didn't bother Joshua Valiente. He was used to it. It was the silence. That was what had woken him. The silence, the great breathing of the world, of all the worlds, that he'd always sensed in the gaps between the petty noises of life, the rattling of the weather. At times, he'd encountered embodiments of it, or so he'd thought, like the giant compound entity that had called itself First Person Singular, which he'd found on a world far beyond the gap, with Lobsang and Sally Lindsay. Oh, 40 years ago now. But the silence was more, even more than that, always had been, always would be. It was the voice of the long earth itself, calling to some deep root part of his consciousness. But here, now, the silence was different. There was a kind of urgency to it, almost as if some tremendous beast sat beneath his tree, trying to lure him down to teeth and slashing claws, an ambiguous invitation. Alone in this tree, in this empty world, sleepless, he felt small. Despite all his banter with Agnes and Bill, having passed his 68th birthday since leaving Hell Knows Where, he was well aware of his increasing frailty, the gradual failure of his senses. Yes, he needed those damn glasses of Rod's. The diminishing of his strength. Aware, too, of the imminent end of his own spark of existence. The world, all the worlds, the great panorama of the long earth that he himself had done so much to open up, seemed overwhelming, crushing, vast. It would all go on whether he was alive or dead. What was the meaning of it all? Of what he had done with his own life? And why did the silence, even now, not leave him alone? Such questions had plagued him all his adult life, when he'd let them, and he seemed to be no closer to any answers. He said aloud, "So, Agnes, Lobsang, Sally, are there going to be answers at the back of the book?" But still there was no reply. He tied his ropes tighter, and, alone in the dark, determinedly closed his eyes.